My name is Edwin Cranston, and I teach Japanese poetry, among other things, at Harvard. Several years ago, back in the early 90s, my wife, who is a researcher in East Asian art history, took me to a party of art historians in Cambridge. And I found there a woman sitting alone in the corner of the room. I had been warned in advance that Professor Mizuno's wife was a poet. And so I spotted her and went and sat beside her and told her that I was sometimes did translations and would she be willing to give me examples of her work. She was, and I began to send her translations and she seemed to like them. Then she sent me one book after another. I got drawn in and I began to translate these entire books. I've translated four entire books of her poems. And this essay, which is called The Dark at the Bottom of the Dish, is an attempt to find out why I was drawn to this poetry, which is so different from anything I'd worked on before, because there are no waka rhythms in the work of Mizuno Ruriko. The basic integer of her poetry is the declarative sentence and the isolated image. And so my essay here starts out talking about that. Why was it, what was it that I found in her poetry? Whether I found the answer or not, I don't know. But I can give you an example of the kind of poem that drew me in. This one is called Hänsel and Gretel's Island. And it's one of several based on the Grimm story of Hänsel and Gretel, the brother and sister. There was a summer when the two of us lived together on an island. An X was affixed to the small gate so that our house could not be distinguished from the others. I climbed narrow stairs and went into the room, thrusting a flower in my hair. In the room there was an elephant. The elephant faced away and was lost in dreams of the sea. Waves kept breaking over its back until finally it began to be an island. Before long, the island, with its little lamp lit, put us on its back and sank toward the sea night after night. At night, my brother talked on and on about the island. When still in its infancy, the island was captured by people, stripped naked, and even marked with a zoological distribution chart. We too were very ashamed. Even now, the old symbolic markings survived faintly on the island here and there. They looked like marks left by a rope. A track remains of a kind of amphibian that crawled across the island in the Devonian epoch, but nothing is known of the creature beyond the fact that it passed this way. The lonesome island has been waiting for us quietly ever since in the form of an elephant to take us to the sky and the shade of the bright fern forest. During the day, we faced each other across a round dining table and thought only of where the elephant and island had gone. Music for the bone dance reached us faintly on the breeze. We had an inkling. We had come to some country of the east. I gave the elephant the name Dora. My brother gave the island the name Dora. I made a poem about the creepers the elephant handler uses to make his whip. And meanwhile, my brother was writing a long article about the island's geology and the measurements of one remaining enormous footprint. Circling the table, the two of us drew closer and closer to the spot from which the elephant and island could be seen. In many different places, fathers and mothers began to die. War had started among the grown-ups. We were somehow aware of the presence of a strange fish that had mounted the stairs and was listening at the door. When I bent over and picked up the fish, I severed its legs. All the legs were short. Outside the window, we could smell the legs and the old entrails. In the belly of the pregnant fish was a map of something blind, all red and folded up. My brother unfolded the map onto a dark oval platter. It was of a fecund region. The two of us lay down like innocent wounds and studied for the first time in our lives the recipe for preparing a strange fish. we learn that fishes and people both eventually need to be healed. That was the secret of the grown-ups. Deep in the forest, there was a sound of fern spores spilling in golden color. In the oven, the witch was starting to come back to life. My friend had no more breadcrumbs or pebbles in his pocket. And at the end of the brief summer, he died. It was a summer like a small transparent cup. But I had the feeling that that kind of summer was what people call love. It was this poem more than any other that first began to haunt me. It contains perhaps the heart of Misono's narrative, sad and Edenic, the shape of lost innocence itself. Even before it was brought to my attention at the end, Henzel is no longer called Ani, elder brother, but Anohito, that special person. I had no doubt that it was indeed about love. Naturally, it puzzled me too. Elsewhere in his writings, Jung has an interesting passage about fish. In the apocryphal tale of Tobit, the fish is a magic creature that heals blindness and serves as a protective talisman on an otherwise fatal wedding night. Intriguingly, Jung sees a double nature in the fish archetype, both healing and soiling. Sexuality is numinous, both a god and a devil. Such ambiguity is run through Misono's work. She describes the secret realm of brother and sister as a room toward which the ominously ambivalent fish mounts the stairs, while destruction and death in war rage outside. In that room, brother and sister enter the abyss of sex. For them, a love that will heal all. They prepare the fish, thus discovering the secret of the grown-ups. That its eating is a sacrament, sacred and accursed, troubles the poem. And behind the innocent wounds lurks the figure of the devouring witch who is coming back to life. Innocence once lost, there is no prophylaxis to keep her at bay. Hänsel and Gretel, the original Grimm story, is about being eaten as well as about eating. In Misono's poem, the witch finally eats her victim. Death and the end of childhood coincide. All that remains is the memory of the island and a summer like a small transparent cup.